You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 301. And in this episode, I chat with Lucy, who has kindly agreed to share her story with us. In particular, we talk about her OCD story, developing an eating disorder, going to residential treatment, using substances, the effects and trauma from abusive relationships, including sexual assault, suicidal-themed OCD, somatic OCD, harm-themed OCD, some of her compulsions, getting diagnosed, her experience of doing exposure and response prevention, worrying about coronavirus and moral scrupulosity, obsessing over medication, the powerful moments in therapy that resonated with her, the trauma of OCD, words of hope, and much more. And thank you as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that I do. And NoCD now operate in the USA, the UK, Australia, and parts of Canada. So if you want to find out more about their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you, as always, to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. Thank you to Lucy for sharing her story, for her time, and for being so vulnerable. And without further ado, here she is. Welcome to the show, Lucy.
Thank you so much.
It's good to have you here. So as you know, your story, you know, as little as much detail, I'd love to hear it.
Sure. So with OCD, at the time I didn't know, but my first symptoms were about 8 years old. Hmm. And it most of the time circled around my mom and worrying about her being okay in the night. So like I'd be okay during the day. And then when it came to nighttime, I would have to be sleeping with her to, you know, I'd wake up multiple times in the night and just check she's breathing. Hmm. So I had so much anxiety around like her dying in the middle of the night for whatever reason. So if I couldn't sleep with her, I would just like have panic attacks the entire night, and just basically not sleep. So I guess the compulsive part of that was sleeping with her and checking throughout the night.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And then as I got a little bit older, I had kind of like some personal issues going on. Like my parents got divorced. My mom got cancer. So that kind of played into those obsessions a little bit because she actually did get sick. So, so that was kind of my first bout with, extreme anxiety and intrusive thoughts and stuff like that. So around that time, with the divorce and, you know, my mom getting sick, my obsessive behaviors sort of latched on to eating. So I developed an eating disorder. I like had anorexia and bulimia. And that was kind of my outlet for control and, compulsiveness, if you will. So, once it turned into an eating disorder, I started talking to school counselors and stuff like that and disclosing that I was having some suicidal obsessions. Mm-hmm. But since I was 12 at the time, I wasn't articulating it the way that I meant it to come out or not really able to articulate that it wasn't something I was resonating with. It was... Yes. You know,
so it's an obsession versus you actually have a, you know, you're thinking about it.
Right. So they heard that as kind of you're a danger to yourself.
Yeah.
So that coupled with the eating disorder, I was sent to Utah for residential treatment for mainly eating disorder, but they also, you know, talked about everything else there. I had no idea that anything was OCD related. As far as I knew, I was just very unstable. And it was really difficult because I was 12, 13, and mostly everyone there was 30s, in their 30s. Wow. There was maybe two 17-year-olds. But it was very difficult. So after I got out of there, I spent like 5 months there, and I did feel as though my eating disorder got a little better in the moment, but none of the kind of underlying issues were addressed. OCD was not even on the, you know, drawing board of what might be going on. So after I got out of there, I went to an alternative school for 2 years, which is kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with what that is. It's a school for kids, teenagers who have issues, basically. Like, you might have a substance abuse, you might have depression, you might have extreme anxiety, whatever it may be. So I was there, and I was sort of out of place because, you know, with OCD, sometimes it can look invisible. It can look like, why are you here? You know, like, do you have anything that's actually going on? And I didn't really know, but I stayed there and I talked to the therapist there, and they eventually were like, we think you can go back to your normal high school, to public school. So, so I did that. And once I got back into public school, I kind of picked up on the substance abuse and all that stuff, because I realized one day when I smoked weed for the first time, all my obsessions went away. And I was able to eat without, you know, obsessing about my weight and all that stuff. And it was like a light bulb for me. It was like, why haven't I been doing this sooner? Like, it was a toxic match at first sight. So from there it progressed, you know, to other things and, you know, drinking and other drugs and stuff like that. And that went on for about 10 years. So it went on for a long time. And I kind of attribute that to like self-medication, obviously. So during that time, because of the questionable situations I was getting myself into, I experienced two rapes, druggings, multiple just terrible things that happened, adding to this trauma, and buildup of kind of mental unwellness, if you will. And it all came to a head when I was in an abusive relationship. It was so bad that, in my head, it was like, I'm either going to die or I'm going to get out of this. Whether it was from drugs or the abuse or whatever. I eventually was able to get out of it. And that's when I decided I'm going to be sober. At least for the time being, especially, you know, hard drugs and stuff like that. So I was sober for about a year, and that's kind of when all of this stuff came back. So, all of the symptoms that I was hiding with substance abuse and whatever, they came back and I didn't even see them coming, you know? So they hit harder than ever before, because there was these added layers of trauma that were kind of contributing to the, you know, layers. So I was in a relationship after that, which was not great, but it wasn't, obviously it was nothing compared to the last one. And we had been out with friends, and I had had like a couple glasses of wine. We smoked a little bit of weed, and I was looking out the window. It was like a normal day. And just all of a sudden I felt like I couldn't breathe. And, this was just an acute onset of sensory motor OCD. So I was just so like hyper aware of my breathing and, all of my bodily, you know, functions or whatever. And I just started hyperventilating. I couldn't breathe. My tongue was turning purple. Like, I immediately was like, take me to the ER. So I went to the ER and they did all these tests and they were like, we'll test your lungs. We'll see, you know, you do have asthma, but nothing's like anatomically wrong with you, you know? So I was not happy with that answer.
Of course, yeah.
So I left, you know, I felt better for a couple of minutes. I left and these debilitating panic attacks were just hitting me hour after hour for days. So I went to the ER like 3 times in 3 days, until I was like, okay, I think these are panic attacks. And those kind of just subsided a little bit. And flash forward maybe like a week or two or three or whatever. And I kind of attributed it to, oh, it's my asthma acting up. So I took a weed edible because at the time I was still, you know, I wasn't, obviously wasn't doing hard drugs, but I was still smoking weed and still drinking. And I had made them myself. So they were very, very, very potent. And this is the first time harm obsessions came upon me, and it was frightening. It was, to say the least. I can just remember sitting on the couch and just looking down, my cat's in my lap, and a very like vivid, intrusive image of me stabbing her came across me. And, you know, I was under the influence of something as well. So I was just, you know, horrified. I was like, what in the world? And then I look over and my ex-boyfriend at the time was sitting there, and the same thing happened in my mind to him. So intrusive image of me stabbing him. So I just was like, okay, maybe I just made these too strong. took a shower, laid in bed for like 6 hours until it wore off. And I just was like, I'm never having an edible again. I'm done with it. And I thought that once I came down from that high, they would go away, but it never went away. It never went away from then on. it's at for now, 'cause I'm, you know, in remission, but so that's when it started, and it just was building this momentum in my mind. So it started off with the images, and after thinking about it for a couple of days and not being able to sleep or eat or anything, I was like, not knowing any like what it was, I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll just get rid of anything in the apartment that makes me think that or makes that come into my brain. So I started off with obvious things like, you know, a giant knife. I was like, okay, I'll hide that in a certain area. I remember I hid one in a pressure cooker. I put it in a box, taped it, and hid it in a pressure cooker because I was so convinced that I was going to sleepwalk and murder my ex-boyfriend. So, you know, it started there, and then that wasn't good enough. I had to put them all in the garage that wasn't attached to the apartment. So it wasn't even, you know, attached to my apartment. So I took all the knives and put them there, and then it became all the pens, all the pencils, all the forks, literally anything. Some things you would even be like, how would that even be a weapon? And it was like, well, my mind disturbed me with that. So, you know, I was eating off of plastic forks, and, you know, it was weird. We would have, you know, we couldn't have friends over because they'd be like, where's your, you know, utensils and, all that stuff. But yeah, that was like agony for like a week. I was going through that. Like, just, I was scared to go anywhere. Didn't know what it meant. I was convinced I had a brain tumor, like most people with OCD have that moment.
But on that, just to jump in quickly, sure. What did your ex think about what you were doing, the compulsions?
So he was terrified of me.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was horrible. Oh, yeah. and I'm kind of, you know, it was horrible for me to go through that, but people listening are probably afraid of that right now. How is the significant other, family, whatever, going to respond to what I'm telling them? He responded poorly.
Yeah. So I was going to say, I mean, you know, not to, I don't want to discredit him. I don't know him, but that's not, yeah, the experience I often hear. Usually it's like, well, surely if you wanted to do it, you wouldn't be hiding it from yourself. Right, you know, yeah. Most people kind of make that connection. But of course, you know, the experience you've had does happen too, but sure. I think it's maybe hopefully less common than, to reassure people.
Yeah, it was horrible. He would cringe anytime I got near him. He tried, you know, we lasted for about 2 years after that.
Okay.
He tried to, but he fundamentally just didn't get it. Mm. I feel like you either get it or you don't. And he thought that the initial reaction from him was, you know, fear and like, oh God, what's wrong with you? And then the subsequent reaction after getting used to it and speaking to my therapist and all that stuff was, you're never going to be normal.
Okay.
You know, and what does that mean for him? You know, there was occasions where he would see me compulsing, and this would be a year into treatment. So sure, it's frustrating that the person you're with isn't magically better. But he would see me, I remember he saw me doing a compulsion, which was, I had a fear of, I was washing a lot. I was washing dishes a lot because I was scared that drugs were on them. He saw me drinking straight from the Brita filter.
Yeah.
And he just lost it. He was, you know, sorry to use this language.
Okay.
But you know, why are you so fucking retarded?
Mm.
You know, screaming, you know, why can't you just be normal? Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And just me sobbing, just, you know, because it came out of nowhere, really. I didn't even know he was watching me. So I was like, oh God, you know, and he just laid into me. He, you know, really gave it to me about it. And I, being tortured with my OCD, was just so heartbroken that somebody would, not understand that I'm not enjoying this. Like it's not something I'm enjoying. And for you to call me, you know, retarded and all stuff like that.
It's an added layer of pain. Fear. Yeah.
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 Of like, I'm just, broken. I have a broken brain, you know?
Mm.
So thankfully that relationship ended. And I'm now in an amazing relationship with the most supportive person I could even dream of. But, you know, there will be people in your story, for some unfortunate people like me, who do treat you like that. And you just have to listen to the little voice in your head that's saying, I don't deserve that.
Yeah,
I need somebody who's cheering me on, not beating me down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was tough. That was tough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, where was I? So so the onset, like the acute onset of symptoms, I was desperately looking for answers. I found an emergency psychiatrist. It was just this, institution that you could make an appointment and be seen within 24 to 48 hours. So I went to this woman, and she was this young Indian woman, very warm, very nice. And I was, you know, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast know how it feels to seek professional help for the first time for violent, intrusive thoughts. It's terrifying. You're like, all right, I might go to jail. Like, but you're at the point where like, I'm in such agony where like, I'm going to take that risk right now. If you send me to jail, at least that my loved ones are safe. Right. So that was my train of thought. So I go there and I'm in my scrubs because I had come straight from work, hadn't slept more than 2 hours in probably 2 or 3 weeks. And I came straight from work and I walked in and she said, "What's going on?" And I said, "I can't eat. I can't sleep. All I do is worry about hurting someone or sometimes myself, but it's mostly other people." And she was like, "How is that kind of manifesting in your behaviors?" And I said, "I'm hiding anything and everything that I could perceive or my mind is telling me could be a weapon." So, you know, she just kept asking questions. She asked about my childhood history. I went over the eating disorder, substance abuse, all of that. And she said, "I want you to know what I think you're experiencing is OCD." Mm-hmm. And I think you need to seek out a specialist. There's something called exposure response prevention therapy. I don't think you should try it on your own. She explained kind of what ERP is. And I was like, okay, you know, this was all completely foreign to me. I was convinced she was going to say I was schizophrenic. I was convinced. So when she said OCD, I was like, you know, it was like a relief because I was like, oh, you know, OCD, like I, you know, that's all I'd heard known at that point was OCD was like, oh, you're uptight and, you know, you like everything, you know, to be neat. So I was like, okay, but I was messy as a child, you know, I was kind of unhygienic and like depressed when I was younger. So that doesn't really make sense to me, but okay. So I didn't really believe her. Like most people with OCD when they get their OCD, I was just kind of like, we'll call it that because, you know, that actually makes me feel a lot better. Thank you. Yeah. And so she prescribed Zoloft and a Benadryl type anti-anxiety because of my history with substance abuse. She wasn't going to give me that. She wasn't. And which was smart.
Yeah.
Which was smart. So I gave it a go for like a week, the meds, and I was just terrified of them. I was, I would remember all these stories that I had heard, or one story that I heard when I was younger about somebody taking Zoloft and murdering their whole family. So I was like, you know, okay, you know, I'll take it. And then the intrusive thoughts just became too much. I was like, I'm going to snap. It's altering my brain chemistry. Like this will be the straw, you know, that breaks the camel's back or whatever the saying is. So I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to dive into ERP.
Yeah.
So, well, even before that, I questioned her diagnosis. So I went to other doctors and it was misdiagnosed with bipolar, which was cool. I go there and he basically told me, I think you're afraid that you're going to act out on your thoughts because you might. And I was like, I just remember just sobbing in his office, just sobbing. And because it was honestly the worst thing he could have said to me.
Yeah.
But I was like, okay, you know, give me the mood stabilizers then. Like, so I tried that for a day, stopped them, was like, this isn't the right doctor for me. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to go with this OCD thing. So I found a doctor that was covered in my insurance with like a $20 copay. I talked to her about the OCD and she was like, yeah, I agree. I think you have OCD. But she wasn't trained in it. She wasn't a specialist. So she was trying, you know, we did some exposures with knives. She brought it in, felt like I was going to nearly pass out. Like I literally like couldn't see. I was so anxious. meaning we probably started a little too high. But after a few weeks with her, I told her, you know, thank you so much, but I got to find a specialist. I have to. You've done a great job, but I need to find somebody who sees someone like me 5 times a day.
Yeah.
So one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me was, I shared with one of my best friends from college my recent diagnosis. And he was like, wait, I just got diagnosed with OCD. And I was like, what? I was like, that it was crazy. And he was like, yeah, I went to a therapist for like 5 months and graduated. And it changed my life. And he was like, where I was at when I first started seeing him, I couldn't live my life like that for one more second. Yeah. Like it was down to that critical level. So I said, oh my God, who did you go to see? And he referred me to Dr. Jordan Levy, of Livingston, New Jersey. Hmm. He is the whole reason I've gotten better. He's the whole reason I've gotten a psychiatrist that I trusted. He's the whole reason I got the outpatient treatment I needed last year when it got really bad. So I started seeing him and we started very, very low. We made a hierarchy, you know the deal. My first exposure was holding a chopstick, or not even holding it, sitting like 10 feet away from a chopstick. And yeah, we worked it up from there to, I would have like a samurai sword in the bedroom while I slept. Which was fun to explain to the ex. But yeah, so we worked all the way from like, I would have a hammer in my purse on the bus, you know, I would watch Forensic Files every day, which was one of my big,
yeah,
big assignments. And it was so hard, because there was a time right before I saw him where my intrusive thoughts were so bad, I couldn't watch any TV. Yeah. Nothing. I tried to watch like Weekend at Bernie's or something and like broke down and started crying because of the scene at the beginning where, my cousin Vinny, there's a scene at the very beginning where somebody's dead on the ground. And I was like, nope, like turn it off. Like, it was so bad that I wouldn't watch TV. I wouldn't listen to music, anything that could spark an emotional reaction. Avoidance was like huge for me. So things started getting better with Dr. Levy almost instantly. Things started getting better the more I engaged in these exposures. And we decided together that I didn't necessarily need medication at that point in time. Things were getting a lot better after about a year and a half. I have severe OCD, so I wasn't one of these cases that graduated in 4 or 5 months. You know, I wish it was, but it wasn't. I'm still seeing him, you know, even though I'm basically in remission. We're about to actually graduate soon. But so things were getting better. And then my relationship that I was in fell apart and the pandemic hit. The pandemic hit and then it fell apart. So I was dealing with that. The pandemic definitely set me back. Definitely set me back, yeah, with washing and harm. OCD took a whole new shape in the form of I could be passing it corona, yes, to people.
Yeah.
You know, and am I purposely doing that? Is it ethical of me to step outside and then see another person? You know, just it was so
yeah, it's like moral scrupulosity at that point. It's
so moral scrupulosity, right?
Yeah
is huge. It's huge in my story.
Okay.
But you know, harm OCD was what led me to be like, oh God, I need help. You know, because it's so, you know, unpleasant. But anyway, yeah, so the coronavirus set me back. And so for me, OCD has always been very much triggered by external factors and external stressors. So it started off with, you know, corona obsessions. But that quickly went right back to harm, went right back to, you know, relationship OCD. I've had, you know, pretty much every theme, homosexual, pedophilia. I've had it all. It's like whack-a-mole for me. But yeah, so our relationship fell apart and I actually was very happy with that. It was hard to go through, because a breakup is hard when you're with someone for 3 or 4 years, and you live together and they're a part of your life. But, I was so happy afterwards because I felt like I was trapped in that situation where I was misunderstood. I was stigmatized. And I was treated kind of like an embarrassing defect, kind of. And I didn't like that. And I was so happy that it ended. So this is about last summer when, so a little bit over a year ago, I'm like feeling pretty good. I'm like over the breakup and, things are opening up a little bit and me and my best friend go on a little trip and everything's good. You know, the summer is a better time for the pandemic, obviously. And then like it starts getting, you know, fall and everything's still okay. And I have my boyfriend who I'm with now, we started dating. So I was really, really happy about that. But as the winter starts approaching, I started, I was aware that the pandemic was going to get worse again and things were going to shut down and I was going to be isolated again. I lived in by myself. My boyfriend lived in Vermont at the time. Now he lives with me. But you know, my parents live in Florida. So I was starting to feel this impending doom of like, and I felt it for months before the acute onset of like the worst episode I've ever had. I felt it. And I was just kind of not thinking about it, kind of avoiding it. I know it, I'm going to be isolated. God forbid my OCD gets bad again, blah, blah, blah. So, slowly my therapist and I, he starts realizing I'm reaching out to him, like, and he's a saint for dealing with this, but like multiple times a day, like, can you just give me a call real quick just for me to be like, hey, I had this thought. What do you think? Do you think it means anything? You know, reassurance seeking. I was definitely a reassurance junkie. And you know, he was so patient and he was, you know, like, this isn't helping you, this isn't helping you. But it was getting to a point where he answered my calls because I was very rapidly declining. Not in a like suicidal way or anything like that, but my OCD was getting really, really bad, really, really quick. I was slowly starting to tell him, you know, it's getting hard to sleep. And that's kind of like my tell, because I sleep like a rock. Like when I can't sleep, that means that something's wrong. Like my mental health. And, so I'm like, you know, I haven't really been sleeping and I'm forgetting to eat, and stuff like that. And just, I'm sure for him, he would meet, like we're talking right now. He was watching this steady, like I was looking more and more black circles under my eyes, you know, like I, have always had kind of an issue with the skin picking. So like my face would be like very picked and like stress acne and like I wouldn't joke around like I usually do when I'm feeling okay. And so he was starting to say, okay, maybe we can meet twice a week. And I was like, okay. And then of course I was like, well, you know, can we meet like 3 times a week or something like that? Cause I was grasping for a lifeline. I felt I was isolated, you know. Thank God I had my boyfriend to video chat with me every night, but it was progressing and progressing and progressing until I told him, I'm not sleeping at all. I'm not eating at all. I didn't show up to work today. And like just spending an hour talking about one intrusive thought, you know, like, I'm just convinced I'm going to, kill myself or something. It started to go on suicidal again.
Yeah.
So it was less about other people. Oh, my notes. It was less about other people and more about myself. Mm. I think because I was isolated, my OCD was like, that's a perfect thing to latch on to, you know? So what happened before I was referred by him to an outpatient program was the most like grandiose compulsion that I started having was going to the ER again. But this time it wasn't, oh God, I can't breathe. Something's wrong. It was, I'm convinced I'm going to kill myself. And, it was just this overwhelming force of like, I need to go to the ER. I need to, like no one could stop me. Everyone tried to stop me, including my therapist. Like you're not, you know, that this is a compulsion to be sure that you're okay. Mm. And just nothing could stop me. I racked up like $5,000 in bills. Yeah, it was bad. And I would go in the middle of the night sometimes. I would try to hold off all day and then I'd go in the middle of the night and they screen, like at the very beginning, I just walked in and it was the middle of the pandemic. Okay. So there's people super sick. Some people were vomiting, like just overcrowded. And that's how intense it was for me that I didn't care. Literally like, Corona wasn't even,
a concern.
Yeah. It wasn't a concern. So I went there and the first time I went, I was like, I'm just so anxious. Like, I think I'm having a reaction to, this was right after, kind of jumping the gun and trying to start Lexapro before I was ready to take an exposure like that, you know, 'cause for me, that's the top tier.
Okay.
Taking a SSRI. So I was convinced, okay, I'm now suicidal because I'm having an adverse reaction to a microdose of an SSRI. And so I went and I was like, I'm so anxious. I think I'm having an adverse reaction. And the guy that was, you know, screening me looked at me like, what kind of reaction? Like, oh, is she about to like go postal or something? And I was like, no. 'Cause like on one hand, I know it's not true. And then on the other hand, my OCD is it's true. So I was like, no, it's like not like that. I'm just, you know, anxious. So he let me in and like I talked to the nurse and she was very sweet. She was like, I know it's a hard time. Like, we'll screen you or whatever. But she just kind of looked at it like, you know, you're anxious, kind of what it, you know. For what it was, she didn't have like this big reaction, like put her in the isolation unit or something. So I left after that. They gave me a Xanax and finally I could sleep for the first time. And at this point, it had been like 2 months since I'd had a full night's sleep. Wow. So I was like, oh my God, like, thank you, Xanax, just for one night's sleep. And then after that, my brain was like, wait, why don't you read the label on a Xanax bottle? So of course I read that. And it's like, if you feel suicidal or depressed or something, call 911. I was like, oh God, you know, I'm never going to take it again. So I went to the ER after that 2 more times. They tried to give me Xanax. I refused it. So they're like, I don't know what you want us to do at this point. And the last time I went specifically to a psychiatric emergency, like crisis unit. 'Cause I was like, they'll know the right answer. So I went and once again, hadn't slept in like 2 weeks at that point fully. And, they screened me, they made me put on a gown. And it was this horrible feeling of like relief and fear because I was like, wait, why am I, what am I doing right now? Like, why am I here? And then also like, okay, I'm safe now. Yeah. So it's so weird to have these two
conflicting.
Yeah, exactly. So they screened me and I gave them Dr. Levy's number, Dr. Michael Barnes, my amazing psychiatrist's number. And I had just started to inquire about outpatient treatment with the Anxiety Institute. So I gave them Stacey Dobrinsky's number too. She was the director. So they screened me and I was in this like terrifying, like, you know, plain little room with like, it was what you would imagine a psych unit would look like. And so after being held for like 8 hours, just cause they had to talk to, you know, they had to wait for the right person to get there. They had to screen me. They had to do all this. They were like, so, you know, you have OCD, you know, that this is how it kind of manifests. Yeah. Why are you here? Kind of thing. And I was so mixed up that I was like, can you just admit me? Like, can you just admit me? Like, I just want to be here. And she was like, you don't want to be here. Like, you're not suicidal. You don't want to be here. You need to just follow up with the good resources you already have. You have great resources. And I was conflicted with that because I was like, I just want someone to hold me down and make sure everything's okay and inject me with whatever's going to cure whatever the hell is going on in my brain. Because I can't bring myself to medicate myself. It was horrible. And they were just like, all right, bye. And I was like, okay, whatever. So I left and my therapist was like, did you get that out of your system? And I was like, yeah, no, we joke with each other. So I laughed and I was like, yeah, that was more hurting than helping. Like I saw some guy who was in a psychotic episode. He was like trying to stab people with a pen. And I was like, this is not helping my situation. Not to stigmatize anyone. No, I'm trying to. but so he was like, all right, so you're going to be with the Anxiety Institute. I linked up with them and we decided after screening me, I was going to do 5 sessions a week. Wow. And I somehow had to work that around my job in the medical field. Because I wasn't showing up to work, blah, blah, blah. I almost had to go out on disability. So we needed an intense therapy. And my therapist didn't believe I needed to be inpatient, like at, what's that one place in Philly? Philadelphia. There's a famous like OCD place in, Philadelphia that I was like, oh, I can just go there.
Yeah.
I forget.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll do this, intensive outpatient. And it was all virtual. And the very first real therapy session I had was on my way into the ER on a video chat. So I was in the car and John Weitzner, he's like a young man. He's a social worker. He was, one of my therapists at the Anxiety Institute. He was great. I'm in my car at the ER and he's like, hey, what's up? And I was like, oh, hi. I'm just, I think I'm going to go into the ER. I mean, obviously I wasn't like, oh, hi, I was very distraught. Yeah. I was like, I just have to go in to make sure that I don't kill myself. I just have to go in. And he was like, let's slow down. And like, what is that going to accomplish? What did it accomplish the last few times?
Yeah.
And then since it was our first meeting, we had to go over my history. So I was, and I understand that we had to do that because he needed to like screen me or whatever. So while I'm like in the acute, like OCD, like moment of like, God, I need to go in because I'm scared I'm going to kill myself. We have to talk about, you know, the rape and like the, like all these things and trauma, you know, he needed to screen me for trauma. He needed to screen me for, all these different things, substance abuse and whatever. So, that was hard in that moment to talk about those things. But he was really breaking through to me because he was helping me slow down like a little bit. He was helping me slow down. And kind of, he was trying to get a foot in the door before I closed it on the ER visit. So he was great. I felt like I could trust him, all that, but I still, at the end of that call, walked right into the ER. And so we made a, and sorry, I'm kind of going on and on. My story is very long and layered. We made a treatment goal, an immediate goal for the next week. It's like, keep me out of the ER because I can't afford it. And it's not doing anything for me. So we were having these sessions. Sometimes they were while I was at work. I would go to my car and I would have these 45 minute sessions where we would do an exposure while I'm in the car. It could be me. I couldn't even at one point eat without washing everything that touched the food. So I would have a granola bar and I'd touch the outside of it and then unwrap it and eat it instead of doing something absurd, like peeling it like a banana and like dropping it into my mouth, which was what, you know, I would end up doing when I couldn't wash my hands or something, which was kind of a really silly, weird compulsion. And eventually we just started making really rapid progress because of the aggressiveness of the exposures. I was at the lowest point I'd ever been. I couldn't eat off anything in my apartment. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. Like I said, I would just sit out on my porch and smoke cigarettes all night, basically, because I was just so stressed and just in that level 10 anxiety. If I fell asleep for even a half hour, I'd wake up drenched in sweat, shaking, like seizure, like shaking. And we had to get in there. we really had to get in there before it got any worse, you know? So we hit the ground running. I started eating off my plates. I started watching any content that might be, even if it was a minute of Snapped, even if it was the intro of Snapped, you know, like we had to take bites I could swallow or else I'd get overwhelmed and regress. Yeah. You know, that's just kind of what happens. So we decided that at the top of my, like at the goal of my ERP, was not to be in remission by the end of this, intensive therapy, but it was for me to be able to go back to like once a week therapy, and continue with Jordan. So our goal was we need to start, thinking about microdosing Lexapro, because I needed it. I needed it as much as I was phobic of medications, even Advil, even like anything that I perceived as able to alter my state of mind or something, felt like an out of control risk for me. So we started, microdosing Lexapro, at the very, very end of treatment. So before that I was holding knives to my wrist, as like harm exposures. I was, watching things. I was purposely touching something that maybe was gross and then eating off of my hands. And there was one moment in treatment with Stacey Dobrinsky, actually two moments that were like huge for me. So for me, confessing was huge. So we did a lot of confessing work because I was like starting to confess weird things and I needed to nip that in the bud before it happened at work. And I, you know, sabotage myself. So we were doing a lot of work with that, but there was this one particular exposure where I was sitting out in my living room and I had this big butcher knife, that you'd use to chop like onion or whatever, which was huge for me, by the way, like that I had already made so much progress to get to that point. And then my cat is very nosy. So she jumped up on the table. So I'm holding the knife, like I'm looking at you right now, up here, like in a stabby position, because that was part of the exposure. And my cat jumps up and starts like trying to rub on the knife. And I was like, oh no. And like, Stacy is just like, she's kind of laughing and we're laughing. Cause for me, it's really therapeutic to joke.
Yeah.
And I told her, I said, I'm really afraid that something's going to happen because my cat's so close to the knife right now. What if you can hear her howling at the door actually. She jumped up close to the knife and I was like, I'm really afraid something's going to happen. What if I somehow trip from a sitting position or, you know, stab her impulsively? And she was like, okay, well just keep it there. You know, just keep it there. As long as your cat's not rubbing her face on the blade, like, you know, we're fine. So she was like, just stay there, just sit there and kind of walk me through what you're saying, what you're thinking. And then she told me to put it on my wrist and she was kind of instructing me what to do. And I had this intrusive thought when my cat's right next to me. And I told her, because it's part of our therapy, which was to just verbally say every intrusive thought.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm afraid you're going to tell me to stab my cat and I'm going to listen because I'm listening to you because you're my therapist and whatever. And she was like, so why don't you stab your cat? And I was like, oh, touche. I was like, okay. So I just stood there rigid as if I'm holding an atomic bomb that is like, if I drop it or if I move, it's going to, you know, so I'm just standing there and she goes, have you stabbed your cat yet? And I was like, no. And she was like, why do you think you haven't stabbed your cat yet? And I was like, cause I have free will, you know? And like, that was huge for me just to have her be like, okay, stab your cat then.
Yeah.
And for my brain to see that in the moment of that intrusive thought, why that intrusive thought is meaningless.
Yeah.
So that was huge for me. And we laughed about it because I was like, that was quick thinking. Like you didn't even have to think about that. Like what if she doesn't know?
and brave. But,
yeah. So that was a moment where everything clicked for me. Or not everything, but it was a powerful moment. And then another moment I had with John Weitzner, who was very, empathetic. He expressed to me, and I double checked with them that I could use their names and all that on this. So that's clear. He had a history of, anxiety. So I felt like I was preaching to the choir. He may have not had a history with OCD, but I felt like very heard when we talked about things. So he was a great therapist as well. And Stacy is just an exposure genius, just genius. And so John and I was confessing so much that we were like, all right, how do we tackle this in exposure? And, he was like, I want you to look at your boyfriend and I want you to tell him something I was obsessing on is like when I was little, something happened with a frog where like, I don't know, I injured it by accident or whatever. So he was like, I want you to confess a little bit to your boyfriend and stop. So like, we're opening that can of worms and then I can't, or we're like cracking it and I can't open it. So that for me was like worse than not confessing anything. Cause it's like, okay, now all the things he could be thinking. So he was like, say this to him, say, and this is my good boyfriend. So he's down for whatever exposure. He said, say, when I was younger, I caused harm to a living thing and finish it. And for me, that was like, I was like on fire. I was like, oh, like I have to tell him exactly what happened so that I know that he's okay with me still. Yeah. That was hard. That was a hard exposure. So for people with confessing, compulsions, that's a great one because you're kind of opening up all these possibilities of somebody misinterpreting what you're saying or whatever they might think. So that was a really good one. So, yeah. And then after that, at the end of that, I finished with the Anxiety Institute. I made impeccable progress. I was like finally able to like sleep and eat and just, you know, live my life a little bit more than I had been. And, we had started microdosing 5 milligrams of Lexapro, and that was so hard to stick with because the intrusive thoughts were just relentless of, this will be what makes you lose your mind and you're going to have an adverse reaction, all that. I stuck with it, been on Lexapro now. I'm at a therapeutic dose. I've been on Lexapro for like 7 months, 8 months or something. And it has made just, I can't express to you the quality of life it's given back to me.
Yeah.
So amazing. That's kind of the really difficult journey that I had in the past year, but I'm living my life in a way that I never have before because I've pretty much since I can remember have had OCD. Hmm. So there's been certain things I've avoided or not let myself do. And that's just not in the picture anymore. I can do whatever I want to do. I can enjoy things with my boyfriend. We can go on adventures. We can take risks, you know? So sorry for that very long-winded backstory.
No worries. And are all the knives back in the cutlery drawer?
Oh yeah. They've always been there for the past like 2 years.
But, okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much for sharing your story in so much detail, being so vulnerable. And yeah, like you said, it's very layered. And when you shared the first meeting with that Indian psychiatrist, the young lady, I don't know, when you shared and she said it's OCD, like I had to like hold myself back from crying. Like, I don't know if that was what you were feeling at that time, but that was...
Oh, I was sorry.
Yeah, really kind of, yeah.
I mean, I truly, truly thought my life was over.
Yeah.
In that moment. And she saw that.
Yeah.
She saw that. She saw that I was tortured. Yeah. And she was the first step, you know? Yeah. She was the first step. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Dr. Nanda Methaswamy. Okay. Still remember her name.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing, so you know, we could say there's lots of suffering throughout, you know, your childhood, teens, 20s. Yeah. You know, and it's obviously the last couple of years that's really kind of turned around. And even that was like a big journey in itself. Sure. So, you know, Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychiatrist, you know, back in the 40s, mm-hmm. He always talked about when someone has a meaning, they can find a way through suffering, basically. And that was his whole therapy was about finding meaning. So I just guess what kind of kept pulling you through all of those years of like pain and turmoil and ups and downs?
I always had this inner little protectiveness for myself, regardless of finding myself in these horrible, horrible situations. In the back of my head, I was always like, you don't deserve that. Like, you don't deserve that shit. And we're going to find a way where you're living a life where you're on your own side, so that regardless of what's happening in the outer world, you've got your own back. And I think that's been the biggest thing, because yes, there's a lot of things in my life that were kind of bestowed upon me, you know, they were in the cards for me, but things were infinitely worse when I was punishing myself on top of that with the substance abuse and the putting myself in these situations with people that are up to no good. And it's not by any means my fault. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's important. Sorry, you can hear my cat howling. It's important the way you respect yourself. And that means the way who you surround yourself with, how you let people talk to you, how you let people do all these things to you, and how relentless you are in seeking wellness, you know? So I always wanted to feel better, and it was misguided a lot of the time, i.e. eating disorder, you know, substance abuse. But once I got my head on straight, it's all pointed in the right direction now. So despite all of the self-deprecating and self-harming behaviors, somewhere deep down there was
a whisper
of like, you can help other people, you can help yourself, and you can be, you can make something good out of this, you know,
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I know I always look at it as like the kind of compassionate voice that's within us, that's in everyone. And for some people it's further down than others, but it's there, and it's where possible, just trying to nurture that to drown out some of the other voices that are maybe destructive or intentionally destructive, but
no. Yeah. It's almost like, when you don't have a strong sense of self, you let the bad things that happen to you dictate how you feel about yourself. So when all these bad things were happening, subconsciously, I was very much so thinking, this is happening because you deserve it. Mm-hmm. That's what's meant for you. So once I kind of distance myself from that, and I have to attribute a lot of the self-compassion work and self-esteem work to Dr. Jordan Levy. In my moments of
take your time.
Yeah. In my moments of complete isolation and like just misery, he was always saying, you're the most resilient person. You're one of the most resilient people I've ever met. This is just another thing.
Yeah.
So he was instrumental in literally helping me build up self-esteem and self-worth from the ground up, in looking back at things that had happened and taking the blame off of myself, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm glad you asked that question, because the most important thing is resilience in this journey, because there will probably be times when you're alone.
Yeah.
So, sorry, not letting you open the wells.
That's okay. But I think, it's a valid point. Like he said, it's kind of like, look what you've already coped with. This is, you can cope with this too, you know?
Yeah.
And I think when we're in it, it's hard to think, how can I cope with this? And everyone's already, various factors in their life have coped with a great deal.
Right.
And you definitely say so. you proved him right.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm always, whenever he says he's like proud of all the progress, I'm like, and Stacy says that, my psychiatrist, Michael Barnes, who's awesome, says that. But you know, I couldn't imagine how happy I am now.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, when you look back at how bad it has been, it can be very emotional, you know?
So. Yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm going to change channels before I cry. just words of hope for people. I should say there's nothing wrong with crying. That's my insecurity.
Crying? Okay.
No, exactly. So words of hope for people with OCD.
Sure. I've thought about this a lot since I've been listening to your podcast, since I got my diagnosis about 4 years ago. Thought about what my billboard would be. I've thought about
that coming,
all that stuff. you touched on it. My advice for people with OCD is be your own protector. Mm-hmm. Like you need treatment. Don't stop till you find it. You know, it's expensive, but Psychology Today in America, at least you can find people who have specialties in OCD with like $10, $20 copay. Mm-hmm. You have to be like your own agent. You know what I mean? Like you have to, find exactly what's going to work for you in order for you to get better. And sometimes that looks like being told you're too messed up. Sometimes that looks like being told you're misdiagnosed. I'm sorry. Sometimes that looks like being misdiagnosed and you have to cry it off and look again. Mm-hmm. Because that's been part of my journey is heartbreak through misdiagnosis. People kind of just looking at me like, this is too much for me to tackle. I'm sorry, I can't help you. And having to reassess and being like, okay, I'm just going to have to find someone else. And now I'm well. So sometimes there's going to be heartbreak in this journey for you and you're going to feel alone. And some people will totally not know at all what you're going through. But as long as you know what you're going through and you won't give up, you will find that, just like I have.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. And I'll share a quote from Freud or Sigmund Freud. And mm-hmm. he says, I hesitate because I'm sure for some people in certain positions right now are going to think that's silly. But he said something like, I'm going to paraphrase, but it will strike you when you look back that the times of turmoil were the most beautiful. Something along those lines. And I think when you're out of it and in hindsight, yeah, there's still the trauma and the pain and, sometimes it just makes the good times even better because mm-hmm. you work to get to those good times. They weren't just given, you know?
Yeah, totally. And all the things I've been through have made me prepared for all the things I will go through.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Yeah. You're way more resilient now and yeah. skilled and tooled and compassionate and all of those things will serve you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And can I just say, I don't want to forget to say this. One of my favorite podcasts that you guys have done, that you have done, was with Chrissy Hodges, who I love. She's mm-hmm. great. It's called The Trauma of OCD.
Yeah.
So there's people like me who have trauma that has nothing to do with OCD in some ways. And then the additional trauma that I have endured through having harm OCD and OCD in general, what it's taken from me, whatever. So I think that podcast was amazing. I think it's interesting because I actually did some cross exposures for trauma and OCD. So I'd be holding the knife or whatever, and I'd be telling the story of, you know, various traumatic events. Proving to myself that the trauma won't make me snap, basically. The trauma, I can handle talking about it and all those things. So trauma, I think, is such a thing we have to talk about. And I love that you guys did that.
Thank you.
And also all of Stephen Phillipson's episodes are just great because I'm in the medical field. I like the medical side of things. And there is a medical biological side of this. So I love hearing about like the neurological component and stuff like that. So I think it's really cool you touch on that too. So appreciate that content.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And I have to give Chrissy the credit for that. I think it was her idea to do that topic. So I'm glad we did it.
Invaluable what you guys have given to me before I even got to ERP. I was listening to you. I was listening to Chrissy. So that's 4 years ago. So you guys are a part of my story. Truly.
Thank you. No, I mean, it means a lot. So, you know, the next question, which is 20-year-old you, well, you pick up the phone, you call her, what do you say?
Yeah. So I wrote some notes down. I just want to see.
Yeah.
So, and we touched on this too. So you really, you asked a good question earlier. But what I wrote down is all your suffering will be worth it. God, can I stop crying? You will see a day when you live a life you are proud of, and you will be your own hero. Yeah. So.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. So Billboard, what do you want written on that?
So my therapist, Dr. Levy, helped me because, you know, I'm a very thoughtful person when it comes to things like this, because I want to, you know, call me meticulous, but I want to make sure I get it right. Yeah. But we talked, I was like, I don't know, what should I build my billboard be? And we talked about it a little bit and he was like, I think she persisted, period, would just be a good thing. And I was like, yeah, I like that. So
nice. Nice.
Yeah.
And then lastly, anything else that you wish you could have shared today?
Just I'm grateful that we have we being OCD people, anxiety disorder people, what have you, have outlets like the OCD Stories, like Chrissy Hodges. I'm so glad that we're living in a time where this wasn't even the case 40 years ago, 30 years ago, no. Where my therapist is just magnificent with ERP. And I just feel really lucky for all the resources I have, because I have, it's like I have an army behind me. So gratitude, really.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much for, like I said earlier, for sharing your story in so much detail. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you so much. And it was amazing to meet you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.